Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. You know, we cover a lot of fun topics and I think interesting topics and informative topics. And one topic that always seems to be popular is when we talk about insects. And really pleased to have back PJ Leash. He is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Took over for Phil Pelletieri not that long ago. He holds degrees in biological sciences and entomology from the UW. And BJ, great to see you again. Thanks for coming by.
Pleasure to be here.
We have lots of things we can talk about. By the way, I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. You may have an insect in your house right now that you'd rather not be living with, or maybe a question about one. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. If you have a photo of an insect you maybe want to identify, we can PJ can take a crack at that as well. If you post it on our Facebook page, just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post it there, and we'll take a look and see what we can come up with. And you can post a question there as well while you're at it. We have, again, lots that we can talk about. There's a really cool insect that lives in Wisconsin, though, that looks pretty scary in a lot of ways, but it isn't. I always thought it looked pretty cool myself. It's, and I want to make sure I pronounce it right, Ichneumon, wasp.
Yep, so these certainly are neat insects, Larry. And they do look a little bit intimidating, though, the first time that you see them. And the first time that I stumbled across one, I must have been about 10 or 11 years old, and it's a wasp with a body about an inch and a half, almost 2 inches long. But the females have these very, very long egg-laying devices, which we call ovipositors, that stick out the back end of the insect. And if you stretch those out, they can be a couple inches long. So we're talking about a wasp that might be about 5+ inches long. And it looks a little intimidating.
Looks like a stinger, actually.
It does look a lot like a stinger, but actually it's not. It's technically called an ovipositor, and it's an egg-laying device. And what the females do, and we actually have a couple of different species in the state, but they have very similar biology. So they are parasites of other insects that live in rotting trees. Those other insects are called horntail wasps. They're another wasp-like creature. But they're living in soft, rotting wood. And so what these females, giant Ichneumon wasps, do is they take that egg-laying device and they drill into the rotting wood. And they can drill in pretty deep. We're talking 3, 4, 5 inches deep to find these other insects that are in there. And at that point, they're going to lay an egg, which is going to hatch and then parasitize the other insect that is in the rotting wood. So definitely cool creatures in terms of their biology, but also just bizarre looking.
Yeah, they really are. And we have, and Judith's already taken some photos, and I think she's putting up online, and we'll have in a minute, a couple of photos of the species that you brought over. They're beautiful, actually, when you look at them closely.
They are actually very elegant insects. Delicate looking bodies, really cool color patterns on there, and they're not all that uncommon if you know where to look. If you really wanted to see these things, what I do is about once a year in June, I'll head up to the Baraboo Hills. And if you look for trees that are still standing but dead, and often it's some larger pines perhaps with holes from the pileated woodpeckers. You get these oblong holes. If you get up close to those trees, that's usually where I find these wasps. And I've had days where I've stumbled across 20, 30 of them on a single tree, which is a little unnerving when you see these giant wasps all hanging out in the same spot, but you have to realize that they're harmless.
Oh, that really sounds cool. So, but are they found throughout the state?
I get pictures from across the state. So they are fairly common, and they do pop up just about everywhere.
And their life cycle, what's that like?
As I mentioned, they're parasites of these other insects that are in the wood. So the females will lay eggs, drill through that wood with her ovipositor, lay the egg. Her egg will hatch, parasitize the insect that's in there. And then about a year later, we get our next batch of adults.
And so the mom, once she lays the eggs, she's done for pretty much?
Yeah, she may live for a short while, but generally not too long. It's thought that the adults don't feed a whole lot, or if they do, they're not taking in a whole lot of sugars and energy, that kind of thing. So they're thought to be fairly short-lived insects.
And the eggs are spent the winter is covered because the eggs are inside a tree.
Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of insects that spend the winter in rotting logs, inside of trees. And so there are all kinds of neat adaptations to withstand the winter. There's some natural antifreeze chemicals that insects can make and all kinds of other tricks up their sleeves.
Well, they're pretty cool insects, that's for sure. You can join in, too. PJ Leash, our guest today, talking about the world of insects with him. Maybe you have an insect you have a question about, or maybe there's something you'd like to get rid of. I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And somebody told me already they had some ants showing up. Judith told me. Had some ants showing up in her kitchen. On the floor.
Well, it is that time of the year, Larry, because things have been warming up. And when we get cases of ants indoors this time of year, what I suspect is that there may have been a nest possibly in the house but near an exterior wall so that they were kept cooler during the winter.
Okay.
If we have ants that are active in the middle of winter, in December, January, that tells us that the nest is somewhere inside the house where they're warm. But if they've just become active recently, it could be a nest, as I said, in a wall void or maybe just outside the house and that warmed up enough because it's a south-facing wall that some of the workers start wandering in. And we have a number of ant species that have become active recently and have started wandering around. And in some cases, we'll get swarmers indoors this time of year, which catches people off guard a little bit.
Yeah. What do you do about it?
Well, depends on the species and if we're seeing workers or swarmers. For some of the species, when we see swarmers, it's really an accident that they showed up in the house. We have a species called the citronella ant, for example, that nests down in the soil, and they have no interest in people food inside homes. But occasionally, if there's a crack in a concrete slab foundation in a basement, the swarmers end up coming out through that, and they fly around the house. They die pretty quickly thereafter, and it's just a nuisance thing. We don't really need to do a whole much about them other than take out the vacuum cleaner and suck them up.
Maggie in Janesville has a question. Hi, Maggie. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I appreciate taking my call.
Sure.
I have Asian lady beetles, and they, at this time of year and in the fall, they cover the outside of my house. I have read that they like to nest on south side light-colored vertical cliffs in Asia, and I have a tall south side light-colored cedar-sided house that has a lot of little crevices for them to nest in. I'm wondering, I've tried it last fall. I spent bunches of money caulking. I'm wondering, is there anything else I can do? Is there any bioattractants I can use? Some way to help control them in the house? They're okay outside, but how can I help them collect them in the house? Because I've been vacuuming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure. So based on the description, Maggie, as you said, in nature, they like to find some vertical surfaces to naturally spend the winter. And based on the description of your house, it's kind of a perfect scenario to draw them in. And I did notice kind of an uptick in their activity last fall. Their numbers seem to be going up a little bit. You're on the right track, though, with the caulking. That is the primary thing that we like to recommend, is physically sealing things up on the outside of the house so that the insects can't get in. That's going to be your long-term solution to stop them from getting in. Once they're in, we've kind of lost the battle, so to speak. Another option for folks in cases where we seem to have problems with them every fall, either you can do this or hire a pest control company. You can apply an insecticide just to the outside of the house. And basically what this is it creates a chemical barrier so that as the insects try to get in mid-September or early October, sometime around then, it's going to prevent them from getting in. Some of these products have repellent properties, but they'll also kill the insects as they're trying to get in. And so that's going to stop them from getting in and prevent issues.
There we go.
Would that be applied to the whole outside surface or just around the windows?
Wouldn't you do the whole wall, the outside wall?
Yeah. I mean, with this one, they like to kind of hit the wall and crawl upwards a bit. So you might not necessarily have to work down at the bottom of the wall, but you want to focus mostly on the southern-facing walls of the house and maybe the western side. That's where they seem to be attracted to the most. But we go around the windows and up in the soffit area as well because they can sneak in through gaps up there.
Yeah, good point. Thank you, Maggie, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Gerard a chance to join in from Milwaukee. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've had a run-in, and I had to do some research on my own because I didn't know what it was, but found out that they were bald-faced hornets. And, wow, aggressive as hell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So bald-faced hornets are actually a type of yellow jacket. They're related to our German yellow jackets and other species that we have, but they do tend to be larger, black and white in coloration, and in some cases, I mean, they can get close to an inch for the queen, for example. So they are good-sized insects. If you have a nest close by, you know, above a door hanging from a soffit area, they can be fairly aggressive. In general, though, if they're out in the back corner of a yard, they tend to leave you alone unless you're mowing near there regularly or kids are playing near there. And surprisingly, they can do a lot of biological control in the landscape in terms of going out and feeding on pest caterpillars in the garden, that kind of thing. But if they are up close near the house, the trick with those is we want to catch them early in the year. So with their life cycle, they do form this large colony, but they only spend the winter as a few members of the colony, which are fertilized females that have mated late in the summer and early fall. Those will find overwintering spots, sheltered locations. It could be a rock pile, a hollow tree, that kind of thing. And so in the spring, those individual females have to start their own colonies from scratch. And so if we go out and we see a colony when it's starting and it's small, and we take care of it then, there's less of a risk for being stung because there's fewer wasps and bald-faced hornets overall. And if we catch it early and eliminate the nest, we prevent it from building up to that large size and really becoming potentially dangerous.
Yeah, unfortunately, I happened to have an extremely large nest in a tree in my front yard and was intimidated as far as trying to take it down. So what would your recommendation be at this point in the season?
Okay, so you're talking about the nest that is still there from last year?
Yes.
Okay. Well, so essentially it's abandoned. They do not reuse the nest year to year. And as I said, the colony dies out. So they vacated it. There's a few females from that colony most likely would have found a sheltered spot to spend the winter. But at this point, that nest is going to be empty. So there's really no risk of going up there and pruning it out of the tree.
Okay, excellent. I'm glad I called. I wouldn't have known that. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Julie in Madison has something for us. Hi, Julie. Thank you for calling.
Well, hi. Thanks for having this show. I love the show. I have a question. I was sitting outside in this nice morning, and here this like small monarch came down and was flying around and sort of hung out for a while. And I thought, my gosh, isn't it kind of early, or is this a typical monarch, and what is it eating?
Well, based on the time of the year, I suspect that it probably isn't a monarch. We do have a number of other orange butterfly species in the state, and overall we've got about 100 or so butterfly species in the state. We do have one particular family where we have a number of small butterflies that are either light blue color or in some cases orange color, and I suspect it's probably from that particular group of butterflies. In terms of their food source, we'd really have to narrow it down and see the exact species to know what they're feeding on.
What typically would butterflies be feeding on this time of the year that would be here?
Well,
not a lot here.
So as adults, butterflies have essentially a soda straw for a mouth part. They've got this long tube, and so they're looking for nectar sources as a sugar source for energy. So they're probably out and about scouting for any type of flowers and nectar sources that they can find at the moment.
Is that my hummingbird feeder?
Well, potentially, if that were the only sugar source around, it wouldn't surprise me too much if they tried feeding on that. But there are some early season flowers that are popping up.
Okay, like the crocus.
Crocus are starting, yeah.
Right, okay. All right, well, it was just amazing to see.
Certainly.
Yeah, sure, it sounds wonderful. And I can tell the crocuses and other plants are starting to come up because my nose is starting to run again this year with allergies. So, Julie, thank you so much. Jolie in Mosinee, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling to ask, we had last year wasps in our house. In the walls, and we had the hardest time trying to figure out where did they come, because all of a sudden we'd see one on the window, and we had I would say, maybe 50-100 that they would die and they'd be on the ground. We had to vacuum them up, and we were constantly vacuuming. And they stayed up on that second floor, and maybe occasionally we'd have one on the first floor, but everything was up on the second floor in one room in particular. Tried to watch where they came from, couldn't figure it out. We had a bug pest come, and she said, you know, seal areas even by your fans, ceiling fans, too. What I'm worried about is, are we going to have that same problem this fall or even this spring? Are we going to see wasps again?
Well, probably not in the spring. That would certainly surprise me. And what I suspect it is one of our yellow jacket species. We have some that will get up and nest in hollow void spaces. So it could be a soffit area in the house. And that's my guess is what has gone on, is that a female queen last year must have found her way into the soffit area, built some kind of nest up in the house. And it's really late summer when their colonies are at their largest point, because they said they start from scratch and build up in size. So that would explain why you saw them later in the summer and into fall. Usually by mid to late October, those colonies are dying out on their own because the members of the colony simply starve out. In terms of what to do about it, as I said, I think it's a species that's sneaking in somewhere. The ultimate solution, this is a little trickier because it sounds like you have a two-story house, but you'd have to get up and inspect the outside of the house for entrance holes where they got in. It could be little gaps in siding up in the soffit area. If we can find those and seal them up with either caulk or expanding foam, that's going to prevent the insects from getting in, and that's going to stop another problem this year.
Yeah, good tips.
Okay.
Thanks, Jolie, for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today about the world of insects here in Wisconsin with Patrick P.J. Leash, who has degrees in bioscience and entomology from the UW. He manages the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have an insect question, I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. We have lots of emails. You can email us, too, at talk@WPR.org, or if you've got a photo and a question, go to our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. Randy in North Branch, Minnesota, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good morning. See, my question was regarding, I was prompted by the gal who had the Asian lady beetles on her cedar siding.
Yeah.
We have the same type of home, and it's time to paint this spring. And I've been looking through additives that can be added to paint to help prevent and kill off some of those beetles. And there's a product called Bug Juice that has a synthetic pyrethroid. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but I'm wondering if you've had any experience with that product or that type of chemical, and whether there was any success.
All right. What do you think, PJ?
Sure, Randy. Well, what was the name of the particular product again? Bug juice?
Well, that's the product that I saw on the shelf at local box stores, but I'm sure there's other ones out there.
Okay. So I'm not familiar with that particular product off the top of my head. The thing, though, is that if it's one of these synthetic pyrethroids, this is the broader class of insecticides that if you spray in the fall for Asian lady beetles, that's the kind of products that we use. So in terms of being effective, it makes sense to me that it would work. My only question, because I'm not familiar with it, is I don't know how long that particular product is going to work and last when you mix it with the paint.
Sure.
So typically when we go out and make an application in the fall, these types of chemicals, the synthetic pyrethroids, they have a lifespan, depending on how they're formulated, ranging from a week to maybe 4 weeks or so tops. So typically they break down fairly quickly, and if it's something that is mixed in with paint and it only works for a matter of a month or so, you know, that's not going to be long-term protection. So I just don't know for that particular product off the top of my head how long it lasts in terms of residual activity.
There we go.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Randy, for calling. Appreciate your call. We got an email from Paul wondering about the current state of the bee crisis, both in-state and more widely.
Okay, so there's a lot of research being done about bees at the moment. And it's not just honeybees. It's honeybees, bumblebees, native bees, and we have 400 to 500 different species of native bees in the state, and a lot of them seem to be in decline. Now, if you dig into the scientific literature and the research, the general consensus at this point is that there isn't a single cause for bee decline and then pollinator decline in general. If there were a single cause, that would be great, because we would just have to alter our behavior a little bit, change something we're doing, and that would fix the problem. But unfortunately, there's lots of things going on. General habitat loss, for example. We just don't have the prairies around anymore to the extent that we used to in terms of just general wildflowers. People are being more proactive in planting pollinator gardens, that kind of thing. But we've taken the habitat that they had at one point and we've crunched it down in size and then fragmented it. So it's little bits and pieces instead of continuous habitat. So in addition to habitat loss, there are a number of diseases. Honeybees can get all kinds of viruses and microorganisms and protozoa, things like that, that can affect them. There are parasitic mites, which are, at this point, seem to be one of the major drivers of this, or a stressor. There are tracheal mites that can get into basically the breathing tubes of bees like honeybees. And then there's a particularly nasty one called a varroa mite, which is basically, you can think of it as almost like a tick, but on bees. It's an ectoparasite that essentially drinks the insect's blood or hemolymph, and that can stress bees. And then there are things such as pesticide use that may be involved. It may be direct, such as if a flower is sprayed, for example, and a bee comes by and visits it, you know, that can have an effect on the bee and potentially kill it. But there are some indirect effects, and it might not be exclusively insecticides. It could be fungicides and herbicides that are being used. They all link together. A good example of indirect pollinator effects, not necessarily for bees, but with monarchs. If we are using Roundup Ready crops and using broad-spectrum herbicides, and that's reducing the milkweed numbers out there, you know, that's going to affect insects like monarchs that rely on them. So in general, a lot of research is being done at the moment on pollinators and bee decline, but as I said, it's really 50 different things acting together. There's not a single cause.
There we go. We have an email from John, who wonders about the Gallinipper mosquitoes. He understands they're enormous and very aggressive?
Yep. So there's a species that's commonly called the Gallinipper. It's Serafia ciliata, and this happens to be our largest mosquito species in the state. So we do have it around, and they're about an inch long or so. So definitely good-sized mosquitoes. They can be fairly aggressive. Good news for us, though, is they don't tend to be very common. I've never actually run across a live specimen in the state, but they are out there.
Huh. Jay in Ferryville has a question. Hi, Jay. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good day, folks. I was curious. First of all, mason bees. Go for the mason bees. My question has to do with the spotted wing fruit flies that have been attacking the raspberries.
Yep.
And you guys have set up any kind of monitoring system so that people can kind of see how and where they're coming from.
Yeah.
So this spotted winged Drosophila is a relatively new invasive species. It's originally from Asia, and it got into the state. We detected it for the first time back around 2010. So we've had it about 4 or 5 years now. And as you mentioned, Jerry, it can cause quite a bit of damage to particularly raspberries. Our late season berry crops are the crops that get hit the hardest. If you have earlier season strawberries and raspberries, they don't get hit very hard. And the pattern that we've seen in the state last couple of years, we tend to get to late June, early July, and that's about the time of the year when we start seeing our first adults. Now, my colleague in the entomology department, Christelle Goudeau, is our fruit crop specialist, and she actually has several students working on spotted wing in terms of monitoring it and trying to figure out the general patterns of where we see it in the landscape and landscape effects, that kind of thing. So there are some ways that we can monitor for it. And if you were to hop onto Christelle's website, there's some information on there about how to create apple cider vinegar cup traps. Being fruit flies, these insects are attracted to fermenting smell, such as vinegar. And so we can basically use a plastic deli cup, put some apple cider vinegar in there, and then the insects, if they're in the area, some of them are going to get caught in the trap. So we can use that to monitor for them. In general, though, as I said, it tends to be about late June, early July when we start seeing them. After that point, if you've got raspberries in your yard that are late blooming ones or late crop ones, boy, you got to look out because they can really do some damage to those.
Would you cover them? You do a row cover or something?
Well, the problem with this insect, Larry, is that they're so darn small because they're basically about the same size as our run-of-the-mill fruit flies. So in theory, if you had a fine enough mesh screen cover or mosquito netting, something like that, you could cover it. But then I have questions about pollination because you need bees to get in there to pollinate the raspberries. So I would think your yield would suffer. We do have some things we can do, and there are some insecticide treatments that we can use, including some organic options, but you really have to stay on the ball if you want to get a good raspberry crop and spotted wing is in your neck of the woods.
Jay, thanks again for calling. Dale in Madison has a question. Hi, Dale.
Hi. I call them purple mud dubers wasps. I don't know if that's a technical name or not. My question is, do they have the capacity to sting? They seem very docile hornets.
Yeah, mud daubers.
Yeah, so mud daubers can be pretty common, and there's a number of species that we can see in the state. As far as I know, my understanding is they have the capacity to sting, but as you said, they seem to be pretty docile creatures. And so unless you're up there grabbing an adult and poking and prodding it, they're just going to tend to leave you alone.
Okay, very good. That answers my question. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number, we got open lines now. I'll get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And speaking of posts to the Facebook page, I hope people go to it. Tracy sent us a wonderful photo here. What have we got there?
So this is one of the giant ichneumon wasps that we discussed a little bit earlier. This looks like it's our species Megarissa atreida, which is an all-black species and can be fairly common. Another thing I want to point out, which is interesting in this picture, because whoever took the picture must have been in the right spot at the right time. If you look at the back end of the insect, there's this very large, thin, membranous region.
Yeah.
And it turns out that the insect has its egg-laying ovipositor, which can be a few inches long. She has it curled up inside her body. And so she has to go through this process of actually uncoiling it and pulling it out. And in the process of doing this, her abdomen does some weird stuff. She's flipping around body regions and directions that it seems like they shouldn't be able to twist. And as she's stretching out this egg-laying device, it's covered in a membrane, which helps lubricate the parts so that they can work properly. And so we get this, looks like a thin membrane or bubble that stretches out. And that can get to be pretty good size, about the size of a quarter. And so, gosh, if you were a science fiction writer or wanted to do a movie, I mean, what better for inspiration than looking at insects like this?
Yeah, it's really a beautiful photo. And we have, I'm sure Judith has, I haven't looked yet, but I'm sure she has our other photos up from here with PJ showing off his collection as well. Sarah in Madison has a question for you. So let's go there. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I have two questions, and I can take the answers off the air, but I've had a woolly worm caterpillar on my front patio since at least February, and it moves around some. I know it's still alive. I'm just wondering if that's common to have them be able to survive the winter. And the second one is if your guest knows whether it's common for skunks to dig up and eat yellow jacket nests.
All right. Couple of questions.
The woolly bear first. So woolly bears are pretty neat, and they have some tricks up their sleeves when it comes to spending the winter. They can make some natural antifreeze chemicals in their body, and then what they tend to do is in the fall, they wander into a sheltered spot. And so people often see them wandering into a corner of their garage or under the front porch or even back in a shed in the backyard. Again, they're just looking for a sheltered spot to get out of the snow and brutal cold. So it's not uncommon to see them still hanging out in those areas. If it's a warm day, they might warm up and wander around a bit more. If it's a cooler day, they might just sit there for a while. If you wanted to watch it, general thought might be to put it in some type of container just so a mammal, raccoon or something, doesn't wander by and eat it. But other than that, it's really not uncommon to see them around this time of year and be kind of lethargic if it's a cool day.
Email from Bill. I understand that ticks get two blood meals as they grow to adults. The first from the white-footed mouse. I understand these mice are a primary source of the disease. But later on, in a different stage, ticks also take a blood meal from deer. Are deer also a source of the disease, or do they basically transport the ticks from one area to another?
Okay, so a couple of thoughts here. As you mentioned, ticks do feed a limited number of times in their life cycle, and they need this blood meal to go on to the next stage. So out of the egg, they go through a larval stage, and then a nymph stage, and then they are mature adults after that. And when the ticks are small, they do like to feed on smaller mammals, so things such as mice, for example. And that's thought to be one of the main things that drives Lyme disease. We have these small mammals that are kind of a reservoir for the bacterium. The ticks pick it up from the small mammals and then spread it around elsewhere. In terms of the deer, deer don't seem to be a major source of the disease. Same kind of thing with humans. We can contract Lyme disease, but we're not really a source spreading it around. The bigger factor there is the ticks, small ticks, picking it up from small mammals and then spreading it from us. But as you mentioned, I mean, all kinds of animals can essentially transport ticks around. So it could be deer that pick up a couple ticks and then wander 20 miles down the road and the ticks fall off. So that certainly can move them around.
On to Pat in Sturgeon Bay next. Hi, Pat. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wonder if you could help me solve the mystery of these little worms I get in my shed. It's a concrete and brick shed. And near the window, a few times a year, I find a large cluster of these small worms. They're about a half inch to a three-quarters of an inch long, and they're dead. And there's many, many of them, maybe 100 or so at a time. Any idea what they are? Okay. I never see them alive. I always see them dead.
What's their general appearance in terms of color? Are they fairly dark colored?
Yeah, they're very dark colored. They almost look like a maggot, if you know what I mean.
A maggot. Do they curl up at all when they're dead?
Yes, they're curled up.
Okay. And do they happen to have just a boatload of legs on them?
I don't see legs, no.
Okay, that's got me stumped a little bit. My first inclination was that they might be something like millipedes, which we can have wander around during the night, and during the day they're looking for kind of a damp, dark, cool spot to hang out. And so they can sneak into garden sheds, for example. If there's no legs on it at all, that's got me a little stumped. What can be helpful, though, Pat, if you...
Okay.
Next time
maybe
you see...
Maybe I have not looked close enough for the legs.
Well, that could be. Otherwise, one thing you can do next time you see them, simply snap a couple of pictures of them and email those to me, or you're welcome to collect a few specimens, put them in some type of small jar and mail them to me at my lab, and I can examine them under the microscope, and it'll let you know exactly what you're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be happy to do that. I'll consider that next time we find it.
Sure.
Okay, and just go to the University of Wisconsin Insect Diagnostic Lab is the kind of the proper title, and you type that in, and it's going to pop right up, and you're going to be able to go right ahead and download your picture or upload your picture. There are lots of callers now. Kurt and Downing, it's your turn. Hi, Kurt. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I have a question about the life cycle and duration of powder post beetles. I've noticed they prefer certain species of wood, and I read, I think, that they could live up to 12 years inside of wood, and then when they emerge, they leave that powder. But I'd be curious to anything that you know about them.
Mm-hmm. Sure, sure. And it turns out we actually have a couple of different types of powder post beetles, although they can be somewhat similar in their biologies, although they might have subtle differences in host wood preference, that kind of thing. Some prefer hardwoods, other prefer softwoods. But as you mentioned, they can be fairly long-lived creatures. If they were in a nice warm environment, their life cycle is going to be sped up. But if they were in kind of suboptimal conditions, their life cycle can stretch out into a couple of years. And so you might have a piece of furniture that you buy this year, And all of a sudden, a couple of years down the road, some of these powder post beetles crawl their way out. So they do have very, very long life cycles.
Very interesting.
And I read that putting any kind of finish on the wood would deter them.
Yes, yes, that's correct. So it turns out that the females, when they go to lay eggs, they look for microscopic little flakes or slivers of wood that stick up off the surface, and they like to lay their eggs under those so that they're protected a little bit. And so if you take a paint or something else, some kind of sealant, and paint over the surface of the wood, that basically makes it smooth, and it's no longer attractive to the beetles. And so that's one of the big recommendations we make if people are having problems with powder post beetles is put some kind of sealant on the wood.
And there's a borax treatment, is there not?
Yeah, in certain cases, and it depends on the details of the case. For log cabins, for example, if we have problems with powder post beetles, there's a borax treatment that we mix up as a liquid, and we basically paint it onto the wood. And that soaks into the wood, and it acts as a stomach poison, so that insects that ingest that, they're going to die. It's very similar to the chemicals in borax soap, so it's very low risk for humans. So we would apply that to the wood, and then we basically paint over it as another protection.
Talking today with P.J. Leash from the Department of Entomology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He directs the Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him along. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest today, P.J. Leash from the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. We're having a little chuckle right now over something that Kara sent us, which she says, I found these munching on our houseplants, but I think those are not capable of munching. They look pretty cool. She says, what does she say? Oh, they glow in the dark.
There are a few insects that can glow in the dark, although these ones in this particular picture, they look like a plastic kid's toy, I think.
Anyway, it's a lot of fun. Thanks for sending that along, Kara. Appreciate it. Larry in Monroe has a question. Hi, Larry.
Hi, good morning. Box elder bugs. Where does the name come from, and does it have other names? And do they migrate? And if not, how do they survive over the winter here?
Okay, so a lot of things about box elder bugs. Off the top of my head, I'm not aware of any other names for them. There could be something out there, a regional name, that kind of thing. Most folks, though, just simply call them box elder bugs, and they get that name because of their habit of feeding on the seeds of box elder trees, which are technically a maple, and so occasionally they may try feeding on seeds of some of the other maples, like silver maple, but most commonly you see them associated with box elder trees. So that's how they get their name.
But they don't appear to in any way whatsoever harm the box elder tree.
No, not really. The box elders seem to do just fine. So any damage that's caused to seeds just doesn't seem to be very significant for those.
Ah.
Now, in terms of how they spend the winter, so this particular species usually goes through two generations a year, and if we've had a good box elder year, that is, it's been dry, their numbers can get to be pretty high in the fall and late summer, and they're looking for sheltered spots. Out in nature, it could be a rock pile, it could be a hollow log, rotting tree, that kind of thing, but in a lot of cases, they like to get into people's homes because we have cracks and gaps around sliding patio doors and under siding and that kind of thing. They're simply looking to get in to find a nice spot to spend the winter. But then if they're in a wall void or somewhere indoors and it warms up enough in January, February, because it's a southern-facing room and the sun's getting in there, they'll wake up and become active because they think it's springtime. In reality, that's probably the last thing that they'd really want to do if you think about it, because they don't have a food source that time of year. So they're usually going to die fairly quickly. But that's the behavior that we see with that particular species in terms of spending the winter.
And there's no evidence that that they migrate?
No, not really. It's one of these native critters that we have around the state. They might move around a little bit, but in terms of huge migrations like monarch butterflies, that kind of thing, I have never heard of anything like that.
Yeah, there we go.
Because I've been hearing and reading lately about a certain bad bugs, so-called, that affect agricultural crops that scientists are suddenly discovering, surprisingly, that there's many that migrate and they didn't even realize it. But they're about a mile up in the air.
Okay, well, there's actually all kinds of insects, and there's a number of agricultural pests that can migrate or move long distances. So some examples of these, black cutworm, which is a turf grass pest, but also an agricultural pest of things like corn. We have potato leaf hopper, which can go after alfalfa and a whole bunch of other plants. And for these insects, they actually spend the winter, maybe they're smarter than the rest of us, but they're spending the winter down in the Gulf Coast states where it's relatively warm, and they can't survive the winter here. And so in the spring, they have to get carried up in air currents. And so our potential pest problems here can depend a little bit on the weather patterns, because if the jet stream stays high and the winds just never come up from the Gulf, the insects might not show up. In other years, if there's a nice strong wind out of the Gulf Coast states, they could get carried up here early and have higher populations than normal. There's also an insect somewhat related to box elder bug, same general order of insects, called the brown marmorated stink bug, which is an agricultural pest, relatively new invasive species. We found it in the state back in 2010. We haven't had any problems yet in the state, but the potential is there. And out east, they've had major issues with agricultural producers for corn, for example, in field crops and soybeans, for other agricultural things, vegetable production, tomatoes, eggplant, things like that. They can have some major issues. And that one can't migrate per se, but it's a very good hitchhiker. It can get in trunks of people's cars. It can hide away in a box of produce that is shipped across the country. And so that's one of these pests that does show up from time to time. And I've had about 5 or 6 cases so far this year in Wisconsin of that particular species.
Interesting. Larry, thanks again. I appreciate your call very much. I want to give some others a chance to join in. Andy in Dale, Wisconsin, I think it's your turn. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. My question is, I have several mounds of yard ants in my prairie, and I'm just wondering the most efficient way of getting rid of these ants. I have tried boring down a foot or so and pouring in ant insecticide, but they seem to be coming back. Is there any better way to do this?
Probably didn't go down deep enough, PJ.
Yeah, that would be my hunch. And Andy, unfortunately, there really isn't a whole lot else we can do. As you said, boring down, so using a big metal steel rod, a sturdy dowel rod, that kind of thing, even an old broom handle, that's usually the way to go, and then drench an insecticide, a liquid formulation, into those channels. Occasionally, it doesn't get the nest the first time. And the key with these ants and their field ants, you got to kill the queen. If we kill the queen, the colony fizzles out. So usually what I recommend is if you tried it one time, maybe you just didn't quite get deep enough, didn't kill that queen. So I'd give it another shot, maybe try going a little bit deeper and see if that takes care of the problem for you.
Good luck. Thanks. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Mike in Waukesha. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I don't know. This may be kind of weird, but I'm just wondering, do all insects have the capability of... I pulled a tick off my dog, it was a year or two ago, and I don't know why, but for some reason I put it in the microwave for like 45 seconds and it didn't seem to bug him at all. Or is that... can all bugs do that?
Well, that surprises me a little bit. I wonder if... do you happen to have a fairly new microwave? Is it a little bit older, maybe?
Yeah, it is a little older.
Okay. I know with some of the older microwaves, the way that it directs the energy, you could have, even if it doesn't rotate, you'd get cold spots in your food and hot spots in your food. And so I wonder if where the tick was located, it just didn't get enough of a zapping to heat it up enough. Most the insects and related organisms like ticks, so you get them up to about 110 degrees, and that's about their upper thermal tolerance. Yeah, they're done once they get to those temperatures.
So you probably just have a cold spot in your microwave.
Yeah, just tastes funny.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. That's why some of those things taste funny. Peggy in Goodview. Hi, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. We vacationed last summer in a cabin that had been shut up for the winter. And while we were there, there were some bugs that I guess they looked like roaches, although I've never seen a roach, just pictures of them. And a couple came out of the couch, a couple came out of the armchair. They were, one or two were in the carpet. They were about 3/4 of an inch long. My daughters freaked out, and the neighbor told me not to get alarmed. They weren't cockroaches. They were wood roaches, and they didn't bother people, didn't eat people food, didn't anything. And I was just wondering, was he just trying to make me feel better?
No, we do have something called a wood roach. Occasionally I've heard them called tree roaches. And you can go out into the woods in the state here and find them.
No, thanks.
Usually they live in decomposing, rotting trees, tree stumps, that kind of thing. And as the gentleman had said, they really don't have an interest in people food. Typically, they like to stay out in the woods. But if you have a building, a cabin in a really wooded area, occasionally mm-hmm. I do get cases where some of these insects will move in and they'll get underneath the siding and sneak indoors. In cases like that, it's not the same type of cockroach problem that we have in apartment buildings where there's cockroaches hanging out in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. This is more of an accidental sneaking in because they just can't survive very well indoors. So cases like that, we tend to look at the outside of the building, see where they might have snuck in, and try and seal that up the best we can.
Oh, that's a huge relief. Okay, then we can rent it out again. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Billy in Eau Claire. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, you're welcome. We were down in the Black River. Some friends had rented a cabin on the deck. I had turned over this bucket, and there was this huge insect underneath there, and I looked it up, and it was called, I believe, a Dobson fly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was wondering if what you could tell me about them. I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah.
Sure. So these certainly are neat insects, and as you said, they can get to be very good size, couple inches long. Did you happen to notice some very large mandibles or mouth parts?
Oh, we lost them already.
Well, the thing I'm getting at is that the males can have greatly enlarged mandibles, and their pinchers or mandibles can be about an inch long. So rather intimidating looking, females have smaller mandibles. For this particular insect, the Dobson fly, they are strongly associated with water, rivers, streams, usually with rocky bottoms, fast-moving water. That's where the young or larvae hang out. And if you're into fishing at all, the larvae for the Dobson flies are called helgramites. And sometimes you can find them as fish bait. So they spend most of their life living in the rivers and streams. They climb up onto shore to become pupae, and then they turn into adult Dobson flies. And usually if you're finding Dobson fly adults, you're probably within, I'd say, about 5 miles or so of a river because they don't travel that far or live all that long.
Helgramites are probably the best bait ever for perch. If you like to fish for panfish and perch in particular, if there's a perch in the area and you have a helgramite, you're probably going to have pretty good luck. Oh, yeah, they're wonderful bait, that's for sure. Gene in Elm Grove. Hi, Gene.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call.
Sure. This is a bug question. I've had this weird-looking bug in my house during the winter, and now they still come out in the summer. It started kind of last summer, and it looks like a little moth, but it's not real big, and it flutters, kind of flaps its wings a little bit, and it died. It seems like at night it lands somewhere, and it looks like it's going to die, but I have no idea where it's coming from, and it doesn't sting or anything, but it's like a nuisance because I see them. Once I see like two or three flying around the house.
So basically you're seeing two or three at a time maybe and that's it? Or
yeah, well, every day I see them.
Every day, okay.
Yep, and I don't know what it is. It's kind of grayish in color. It's thin in the body.
Would you say, is it like the size of a pencil eraser? That's sort of...
No, that's too big. Oh, a pencil eraser. Okay, I see what you're saying. A little bigger than that maybe.
It's a touch bigger. Okay.
How about that though? I mean, yeah. It's not like a little... It's big enough that you can see it flying... And it looks like it's bigger than it is until when its wings are together in its body, then it looks smaller. It looks like a little dot on the wall. But when it's flying around, it looks bigger.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, my first suspicion is that it might be an insect that we call the Indian meal moth. That's probably our most common moth that we get indoors. They infest a wide variety of food items. So these are pantry pests. They could be hanging out in bad box
of
Bisquick, pasta noodles.
Okay.
If you have bulk nuts, they could be in that.
Cat food, dog food.
Yeah, all kinds of things around the kitchen. Couple of steps to take. You have to do some detective work to find the infested items.
And
you can find small, kind of whitish, cream-colored caterpillars. If you see that, that's certainly an infested item. You do have to keep in mind, though, because you have a history of these things and you've seen them for a while, don't stop when you find the first infested item. There could be other infestations around. And if you're not finding anything, occasionally they show up in really weird items, potpourri and other plant-based items. If it's one of these Indian meal moths...
Should I get someone to come and look at it? I mean, like, this sounds like an infestation type of
thing. It's probably only one or a couple different places, maybe, PJ.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, usually most folks can spend an afternoon sort through their pantry and find the source and take care of it. Occasionally we get a tough case. You're welcome if you snap some pictures, you can send them in, and I can confirm that it's Indian meal moth. But that's my suspicion. We have one or two others that have similar behavior patterns. But I think that's what we need to do is look at the pantry.
I've had that experience, so I pretty much knew what you were going to say that time around, PJ. Thank you so much for calling, Gene. Do a little more detective work, and I think you're going to find where your problem lies. PJ Leash, our guest, with us right up until 12:30 to talk about your insects here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. So happy to have you along today as we take a look at the world of insects with PJ Leash. PJ is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, took over from Phil Pelletieri just a little while ago now, but he does a wonderful job, and it's always great to have him come by and talk with us about what's going on with insects. You can join in. There's one open line at 1-800-642-1234. And email us at talk@wpr.org. Lots of emails and Facebook comments. One from Mimi who said, Red Admirals are butterflies that emerge early from hibernation. They will feast on sap, and that's certainly true. I think we had a photo up of one earlier.
There's actually a number of species that can come out early for both butterflies and moths. If it does appear to be a butterfly because it's out during the day and seems to be a bit more brightly colored, one resource I would recommend, guy I know, Mike Reese from the Wisconsin Entomological Society, he has a website called Wisconsin Butterflies, which is just loaded with great pictures. I know Phil's mentioned it in the past on the show. And what's neat about the website, not only can you see the pictures, but there's a calendar of sightings. And so you can kind of narrow it down time of the year and use that as a clue. So if you see anything out there and you want to know what it is, Wisconsin Butterflies is a really good resource.
Gary in Elgin, Illinois has a question. Hi, Gary.
Hi, good morning. Larry, PJ, what a wonderful, timely show. Last summer, I came out of the ether and realized that I had probably quite an advanced carpenter ant problem in my wood house that has firewood near the house and trees overhanging and all sorts of things. So what I did is get, if you don't mind, I'll tell you what I did and tell me what I did wrong. I did not spray the yard with anything, no, not really chemical. I went after the baiting concept, making homemade borax and boric acid-based baits out of peanut butter, sugar, and so on in little bottle caps. Oh, I had water bottles with, not Wheatina, what is it, how many grits, slightly moistened with sugar and, of course, more boric acid. I had a lot of these all over the place, and it seemed to really make a big difference. And also, I have diatomaceous earth. I got a turkey baster with a little tiny hose on it that I could stick into notch in my wood ceiling. It's a drop ceiling of tongue and groove board, so there's a little gap in there between the former drywall one, and they've got a nice place in there, and I've seen the muss down on my fireplace mantle and so on. So I've been kind of squeezing that thing into there with the diatomaceous earth and plan to surround the whole building with it. Having said all this, am I on target or am I silly?
Well,
so here's my thoughts. An important step would be to figure out if the ants are hanging out inside the house or if it's an outdoor colony, and especially because you mentioned you have firewood nearby just outside your house. Although in some cases we can have a large rotting tree 30 feet from the house, and the ants, carpenter ants, will wander in from there. So narrowing
sure, could
that
even be
down,
a colony elsewhere. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Narrowing that down would really be helpful. How close is the firewood to your house?
Well, it's been in a little bin about a foot away, and now that's at the end of the lot, so probably 120 feet away.
Okay.
I think I've had more than one colony. I certainly have had satellite nests for the main one. I'll see them mound up in the yard, and I'll take action there with the baits and maybe some borax and such. But I know there's one that has been in that ceiling of mine in this great room with the false ceiling of tongue and groove wood separated by a one-inch furring strip and then, or half-inch probably. And I know that creates a little fun there, and there's a drywall up there that they can have fun digging in and making a nest. So I probably have multiples. I've seen other ants that are like them all in the window sills, and I've put ant bait, commercial, the stuff that you get at a hardware store. You'll get six or eight bait stations. I'll put them in. I put the outdoor ones around the house and so on. I've made a little drink for them to have with sugar and such with an upside-down bottle they can go up to.
Well, you're setting a lot of things up for them, Gary. You know, the one thing with carpenter ants, you know, really they're after rotting wood. And if there's something...
Yeah, so if they are hanging out in your roof somewhere, up in the, above the ceiling, I'd be a little suspicious if there were some softer wood, maybe from hail damage, that kind of thing. Occasionally, they get into to spaces where we don't necessarily have rotting wood, but they'll get into that blue kind of Tyvek construction foam.
Oh, sure.
I mean, if we can track down the nest exactly, if you're able to open that ceiling up and get a flashlight and peek your head up there and look around, that might be helpful to do some detective work. Otherwise, in cases where we can't find a nest, the next thing we do is we try the baits. The problem with carpenter ants is they can be a little finicky. So when you've tried the baits, have you seen the ants actually physically at the bait accepting it and feeding on it?
Yes, I have. I've done protein-based and I've done sugar-based. I've done a lot of varieties. So whatever they're hungry for, I've given it to them. I'm just...
Okay.
If that doesn't seem to work, another option, you can buy some baits that are designed more specifically for carpenter ants, and you usually can't find these at the hardware store. You have to go on to a website like a Do My Own Pest Control or Do Your Own Pest Control, and you can usually find some granular baits that are designed specifically for carpenter ants. They might have a higher percentage of boric acid or another active ingredient, but they seem to be accepted a little bit more readily, so that could be something that you could try if you've got some stubborn carpenter ants.
Yeah, there you go. Gary, good luck, and it sounds like you're on the right track. You know, he's cut them back. I still got it. You know, once you can get rid of that wood, that rotting, if there's soft wood or rotting wood, I think that, if you've got it, that's what you need to do.
Yeah, definitely.
Pat in Oshkosh has something for us. Hi, Pat.
Yeah, first of all, great show, you guys. Really appreciate all the information. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The question the lady called in about the little moths flying around in her house.
Yeah.
And earlier, and I was, I've got kind of the same situation, but the beetle I found, and I looked it up, and if you're familiar, it was called a larder beetle.
Yeah.
And I know how I got them in there. It's when I'm doing deer mounts, and that there's some meat left on the skull or whatever, and you'll see where they'll come and they'll eat that off, and they must have got in the house that way.
Sure.
And then I'll see those moths like twice a year, but they sound real similar to what she's seen. Would that be something that she'd maybe have a problem with?
Well, potentially. So in addition to Indian meal moths, there's a few other moths that go after food-based items in the pantry, but we have some small moths that, unless you get them under the microscope, they can look fairly similar to Indian meal moth and others, and they're called clothing moths. And they feed more on fibers. So it could be natural fibers like fur. So that could be a potential source, especially if you're doing some taxidermy stuff and have some furs around. Clothing moths could feed on that and other naturally occurring fibers. So hard to tell exactly what type of moths you're dealing with in this case, if it is clothing moths or if it's something more from the pantry. In terms of the larder beetle, though, you basically hit the nail on the head. They are after protein-based sources, and if you're doing taxidermy and there's a little bit of muscle tissue left on the skulls, I mean, that's what they live for, protein-rich food sources.
Yeah, and I've seen my friend where he left him in the garage, like with some of that hair and hide, and those bugs have come in and completely stripped that off. And I've seen the beetles there. So, I mean, those are the same beetles that I'll see. I just killed one the other day I saw sitting on the wall. So, and I don't know, is there a way to get rid of them? Could you any kind of bait them into a trap, or is there...
Basically, it boils down to sanitation, making sure you don't have leftover, you know, fur, that kind of thing lying around. If you're doing taxidermy mounts, getting things cleaned up as best as you can. One option, if you have, say, a mounted deer head and you want to make sure that there aren't any on there, and we do this for items in museums too, because we could have a historic artifact and you can get some insects in there damaging it, we can use freezing. To kill these insects. And so if you suspect that there might be insects on it and it can fit inside a large chest freezer, we can put an item in there for, you know, 10, 14 days or so, and that's going to kill any insects that are present. So it basically boils down to a sanitation issue, getting things cleaned up the best we can.
There you go. Thanks a lot, Pat, for calling. Appreciate it very much. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. And on to Daniel in Minong. Hi, Dan.
Hello. I've numerous years I've observed a small black insect on the surface of the water. It walks or dances or runs on the surface tension of the water, and sometimes in large numbers, and maybe thousands in a group, moving back and forth in kind of nice patterns. I'm wondering what the insect is and why don't fish seem to predate it?
Okay. Well, my suspicion is that we have an insect called a water strider, which tends to be pretty good size, maybe almost the size of a quarter with their legs stretched out. And they can be very common. You see them kind of floating around on top of the water, and they can move fairly quickly. We do also have a number of other insects, which can be smaller than that, closely related, though, and they can hang out on the surface of the water. So it's probably from a group that we call the Hemiptera, which are the true bugs or insects with sucking mouth parts. So probably something from that group. In terms of why the fish aren't going after them, got me scratching my head a little bit. It's possible that the insects might have some type of chemical defense, just simply be distasteful to the fish, but it would depend on the particular species that we're dealing with.
Yeah, for sure. But I've seen them too, and they're kind of fun to watch.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, a lot of fun to watch. Thanks, Dan. Ray and Rhinelander, your turn. Hi, Ray.
Hi. Once again, wonderful show, and I have to compliment the person you have on. I think he's doing very well, and he is taking over and very well from where his prior colleague took off and doing a good job. You're doing a good job.
I agree.
Thank you.
So anyways, wolf spiders. I like talking about those, and we have we got into a little bit of a controversy on them. I said that I felt they were from the jumping spider family. They're totally different from other spiders and how they are and what they live and how they eat, et cetera, in their habitat and environment. Could you define more scientifically on your end then about wolf spiders and what they really are and what they do? And I'll listen off the air. And once again, thank you. You're doing a good job.
All right. Thanks a lot, Ray.
So both wolf spiders and jumping spiders are similar in that they're a type of spider that really doesn't build a web. They're active ground-hunting spiders, and so vision can be very important to them. But they are indeed from different families of spiders. Wolf spiders are from the family Lycosidae. They are more closely related to things such as fishing spiders. And then the jumping spiders are from a different family, the Salticidae. If you get them under the microscope, are pretty neat to look at because they've got these very, very large eyes, and they have excellent eyesight, and they can do some pretty neat stuff. But other than that, they are from distinctly different families, so they're not terribly closely related other than they're both different types of spiders.
Oh, there we go. We have a a couple of photos up on our Facebook page. Randy sent us a couple of great photos he took last spring. And one is a stonefly, maybe?
Yep, so two pictures up here, and the bottom one is another one of these giant ichneumonid wasps. It's a different species than what we saw earlier. That first picture was an all-black species. This is one of the other species, and there's one or two. I'd have to look at the picture up close in some of my resources to figure out the exact species, but it is a giant ichneumonid wasp. The other particular picture that we're looking at is a type of giant stonefly. Looks like it's from the family Pteranarcidae. These things can be pretty good sized, almost 2 inches long. They usually have a little bit of orange just behind the head or on the underside of the body. Neat creatures. I see them frequently if I'm up in the spring. I used to go whitewater rafting Memorial Day weekend up on the Wolf River. Every year while we're camping, I'd see one or two of these things around. So they are definitely some neat insects. They're similar to Dobson flies in that they're strongly associated with water, streams and rivers, and so you got to be close to some type of river or stream to see them.
You can join in, and by the way, if you have a phone nearby and want to call in, the number is 1-800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quick. We've got open lines for you, but we've got lots of emails too to deal with and Facebook questions. We have an email from Tom. Do spider wasps hunt by scent as well as by sight?
Yeah, so for our predatory and parasitic wasps like that, they can use all kinds of things, including sight, but there are chemical cues that they can go after to narrow in on their prey. In some cases, it may be relying on pheromones of the prey that is being produced. In other cases, it could even be something such as sound. Some insects like katydids can make. So there's all kinds of ways that these wasps can track down their prey and hunt them down.
And we were talking earlier about additives to paint that people might use, and someone called and mentioned bug juice. Well, our poison prevention person for Wisconsin, Donna Lotzer, was listening in, and so she looked up bug juice, which is what had been discussed, and it looks like it is available, but she could see it only available in New Zealand. So,
Well, thanks very much for that comment. And so for any chemical that's used as a pesticide in the state, it has to be approved by the EPA, and then it also has to get registered in Wisconsin. And so, as I had mentioned when the caller called in about that, I hadn't heard of the product before. And so we do bump into products where you can find just about anything on the internet, but you have to double check because it might not necessarily be registered or legal in the state of Wisconsin.
Neil in Pleasant Prairie, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi there, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call.
I have a question. I've got a basement. It's actually a fully finished basement. And we have a spider problem. And we have a lot of animals in the house. We don't really want to use any kind of insecticides or anything that could be harmful to pets. And we have tried a lot of the homemade remedies. We've tried the peppermint oil. I even made like a habanero thing to oil to spray around the house, and it seems to help a little bit. But about this time of year through fall, we've got, there's spiders pretty regularly throughout the house, or I'm sorry, throughout the basement. Pretty much every day I can go down there and find one.
Okay. Well, if you're seeing a lot of spiders in the basement, two thoughts. Either you have some gap on the outside of the home where they're sneaking in regularly, or another possibility is that you've simply got a lot of prey items around.
Yeah.
So all spiders that we're going to bump into in a basement are predators, and so they are going to be present because there's got to be a food source there. And so it could boil down to doing something to eliminate the food source, be it ants or sow bugs or something else around the house. And if we get rid of their food, the spiders just won't have anything to feed on and they won't be able to survive. Now, when it comes to dealing with spiders, hauling out the vacuum with the hose attachment, that's a good way to deal with them. If you're seeing them regularly, though, on a daily basis, there are insecticides that can be used. Now, the thing to keep in mind about these, if we are applying the insecticide to kind of secluded spots, tucked away in the corner where people simply aren't going to be exposed to it, then our risks for people and pets and animals are really minimal. Because unless we're crawling up in the and poking around in the corner of a basement, we're just never going to come into contact with those insecticides. And a lot of the products that are used are from a group we talked about earlier called the synthetic pyrethroids, and they tend to be fairly short-lived, relatively safe for people and pets, although we do have some concerns with cats for some of these products. You do have to read the container very carefully before you apply anything.
Now, is it possible that they're coming in through, like, a drain or I've always heard that sometimes they come in through, you know, a sink or a bathtub drain?
I think that's really pretty unlikely, especially if it's any type of drain that is used fairly regularly. If you had a floor drain that hasn't been used in 10 years, then maybe we start looking into that. Otherwise, if there's any water being flushed down it regularly, that should make it inhospitable for spiders. We do have the pattern where we tend to find spiders in sinks and showers, for example. And I think really the reason for that is that the porcelain is slippery. And so spiders and centipedes get in there, and they simply can't crawl their way out. And so we often associate them with those sites, but that's not necessarily where they're coming from.
Okay, and so as far as the gaps in the house, what am I looking for? Just any kind of gap in the siding or foundation?
Yeah.
Just anywhere where a little critter can get in.
Yep, exactly. So it could be gaps in brick or concrete siding, that kind of thing, if there were some visible gaps under siding where they might be able to get in. Any of those that we can find, if we can fill them in with either caulk or expanding foam, that's going to prevent insects or spiders from getting in the future.
Hmm. There we go. Thanks a lot. Stay listening, Neil. Kathleen in Madison has something. Hi, Kathleen.
Hello. Yeah, we actually use spiders as insecticide as much as we can at our place. I've got a hanging screen that we're in and out of all summer long, so of course it does help keep the insects out, but they still want to come in. So just inside the door, I've got an up light, and I'll just run that when I've got the screen going on, because the spiders will set up shop right next to the light because they know the bugs are going to go right there.
Mm-hmm.
And it really keeps the flying insects, they don't get that much further inside the door. I don't usually have problems. They do get in, I know that, because I see them in the webs. But I just invite those spiders to, like, you know, set up shop where I would like them to be. Then they're away from where I don't want them. Seems to work pretty well.
Yeah. You know, that's true. I had my on the lake home that I had. We used to have that sort of similar kind of thing. The light, the outside light, the spiders would set up on the outside light and take care of a lot of little insects.
Yeah, I'd say as long as you can tolerate the spiders, they can do an awful lot of feeding on pest insects that are around.
Yeah, absolutely. Kathleen, thank you so much. And boy, PJ, we covered a lot of ground here today.
Yeah, we certainly did.
I'm looking forward to having you back, and definitely he will be back and be with us again. PJ Leish, degrees in biology, biological sciences, and entomology from the UW. He's the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Also involved with the Wisconsin Master Gardener Program and the First Detector Network. And in addition, he's an instructor for the Wisconsin Pesticide Applicator Training and the UW Farm and Industry Short Course Program. So he's got a lot on his plate. It's always fun to have him come by, and he will be back again. Tomorrow at 11, an old friend, Frank Armstrong, comes by. He will have some great advice for saving for retirement. And at 11:45, treat my UW Varsity Band Director Mike LaCrone will be on to talk about the spring concert and what's going on with the Final Four game and the Final Four weekend. In the meantime, thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.